Good morning, everyone. Good morning. Thank you all for taking the time to be here this morning. I know Sunday mornings are difficult, and thank you for your patience with our technology needs. Couple of disclaimers and apologies that when we first signed up for this workshop, Dr. Scarupo was coming to be a co-presenter, and she's not able to be here this weekend. She had to work, unfortunately. So at the last minute, I scrambled and found a couple of co-presenters with me. Laura Mains, who is, did I say your name right? I'm butchering everybody's names this weekend. Manis, who she is a lead chaplain in St. Chris's Santa Rosa Hospital and also has been a palliative care chaplain for a while. And also to represent the physician, Bill Holmes, who is a chaplain and also a really well-known and respected physician, is here. And so he'll give us his input when we get to that part of the presentation. So we will have a physician input. Thank you, Bill. And I wanted to introduce myself and tell you a little bit about the title and how this presentation came together and the objectives and all that. I'm Alisi Tremaine, and I work in Baptist Health Corbin. I know I look like a teenager, so that's another little disclaimer to get out of the way. But I've been a chaplain for 10 years now. I did my residency in Norton Healthcare in Louisville, which is where I met Bill. And then in Corbin, Kentucky, which is southeastern Kentucky, I was a hospice chaplain for 6 years. And now I'm in the hospital setting. And my job is divided between palliative care and administrative with the department and then just being a staff chaplain. So playing a number of hats there. But palliative care has been where most of my career has been in. So this presentation has very much a palliative care tone to it, but it doesn't just apply to palliative care and palliative care chaplaincy, I think you see. The title, we added some running puns on there. I don't know if we have any runners in here, do we? Okay, good. Because I know that when we first submitted the proposal, a lot of people were saying, what is a fartlek? What are you trying to say? And those are all just running terms. And it was because what happened is last year, if you were at the APC conference in Louisville last year, we had one of the plenary speakers was a palliative care physician, and I cannot think of her name right now, but she was talking about chaplains advocating for ourselves and some other really, it was a great presentation. And in her presentation, she had a slide. And it was about death trajectories. Was anybody there for that? Okay. And that really caught my eye, and I thought, I wonder how the spiritual needs would vary in different death trajectories, and is there any literature about that out there? So we started looking for articles, Dr. Scarupo, who's the palliative care physician in my team, and just talking about it, and that's how this presentation came together. And it changed a little bit. And another disclaimer is if you were able to download this presentation on the APC website, this PowerPoint here is going to look just a little bit differently because after I sent it, I thought it looked too wordy, and I tried to simplify the slides a little. But if you have them, you can still follow along. You just have more information than what I have up here. And if you don't have them, if you go to the APC website under the 90-minute workshops, you can download a PDF that has the PowerPoint and the bibliography and then what else? I added a couple of things in there that I'll tell you about. So basically, the first objective being identifying and addressing spiritual needs throughout the course of chronic and life-threatening illnesses and different trajectories, and then also collaborating with physicians and other team members to address spiritual needs in their varied contacts. So relays I think are a little more common term, and that is when you pass the baton to somebody else, you run a part of the race, and then you pass the baton to somebody else, and they run that part, and then it's back to somebody else. And that just talks about that collaboration and the team effort that we have in providing spiritual care, whether it's between spiritual care providers or other disciplines in the team. And then everybody's, favorite word, maybe. Fartleks. Fartlek is actually an official running term. It really is. And it is about, or I don't know how it came about, but it's it's when the terrain and the pace varies throughout the course of a run. And it's to improve speed, but also the mental aspect of running. And some people who are serious runners, much more serious than me, use that as, you know, a part of their training for a race or whatever. They do a fartlek run where sometimes randomly they'll speed up a little bit and then slow down. Oh, and that, you know, the reason why we added that to the presentation is because we're talking about in these death and illnesses trajectories, how the needs may accelerate at some point and then stabilize for a little while, and how it may differ. And marathons, of course, is that long course of illness and how we're caring for people sometimes at the initial time of diagnosis and then seeing people at different parts of their illness trajectory, but caring for somebody over the course, the whole course. Oh my gosh, this is the, I thought I had corrected this, that it should not say medium, but median age of death in America is 77. But if you make it to 65, after those who are older than 65, the median age of death is really 84 for women and 80 for men. I just thought it would be interesting to give some facts and some idea about what does it look like in America for people who are dying, and who are they, and how does that show up? So the leading causes of death right now, biggest one is heart disease, followed by cancer, cerebrovascular disease, COPD, and then you've got accidents, diabetes, and pneumonia. And most deaths still happening in hospitals, no surprise. Nursing homes and home have similar averages there, except for the elderly, 38% of the deaths in the elderly are in the nursing home. So for illness trajectories, there are some different trajectories that are standards, and trajectories are basically models of patterns, patterns of how the illness may progress, how the functional decline may happen, and their needs and experience at the end of life. And so for illness trajectories, you have some four basic ones, one being a sudden death, the other one being a progressive decline, which has an accelerated end, the other one a progressive decline, that's punctuated with exacerbations, and then the long gradual decline. And I think the slide that the doctor had last year looked a little like this, if I'm not mistaken. I can't remember exactly if that's the one she had. But this is a functional trajectory decline, which is what this presentation will focus on, mostly on spiritual care and needs related to the functional decline models of terminal illness, organ failure, and frailty. I don't know if you can see. So in this slide, the first one is the sudden death that has a big drop. And then the terminal illness that has, you know, a progressive decline. And then the organ failure is the one that goes up like this. So the terminal illness, we're talking mostly your advanced cancers and some other terminal illness. Organ failure, COPD, CHF, and you see how it goes like this, where you have people who are pretty functional, and then there is a crisis, and then they recover from that crisis, maybe not exactly where they were before, but close enough to prior health state, and then they have another crisis that they recover from. They're a little bit lower from when they started, but they are pretty functional again, and then they have another crisis. And so you have all these crises and then death. And then the frailty, Alzheimer's or dementia, post-stroke, that has that long gradual decline that's a little less functional and longer progression there at the end. And if y'all have any comments or questions, if you raise your hand, Laura will get you the microphone. Since this is recorded, we gotta get your voice in the microphone. So we'll start with terminal illness. And so I divided this presentation with the different trajectories and then looking at what does it look like spiritually and physically. And then we'll talk about interventions, possible interventions for all of those. At the end. And it's easier to talk about advanced cancer with terminal illness because that is the easiest to prognosticate when somebody is getting closer to death, because there's that progressive gradual decline over a period of months or years. And then it has that accelerated decline at the very end, usually over a period of weeks or months, about 3 months before death. So there have been a couple studies, and these studies will show up in that bibliography that I told you about that's part of the PDF. One study was in Italy, and it showed that most cancer patients are well-functioning early in the final year of death, in the beginning of that last year of death. And then about 3 months prior to death is when the most decline seems to happen. So in that study in Italy, 94% of the cancer patients that they studied were pretty, they say, the term they use is free from functional disability. So pretty well functioning. And then this remains stable until about 18 weeks before death. And then at 12 weeks, it dropped down to 63%. And then at 6 weeks, 49%. And so it just kept dropping down after about 3 months before death. And the pattern was pretty consistent throughout all the subgroups for cancer, except for patients with central nervous system tumors. He tended to experience a longer, slower decline in function. And this is similar to other studies. So there's another study. Let's see. This is from 2014 from the Journal of Pain and Symptom Management. And it said that when cancer patients transition to their end of life, symptom distress, anxiety, depression, and functional decline increased slightly. But then there was a stable time period for approximately 4 to 6 months, and then accelerated dramatically to the first clinically significant change at about 3 to 4 months before death. And the overall quality of life deteriorated kind of gradually in the last year, but didn't reach a significant change until about 2.5 months before death. So you have that accelerated decline at the end. Of course, you know, we know that's not true for everybody. Some cancer patients may experience a trajectory that's closer to like an organ failure trajectory. Some of them may progress quicker, but this is the pattern that you see most of the time. And the cancer deaths, it may vary. It may be from something, an acute problem like an infection. But most of the time, it is the cancer itself that causes a death with the anorexia cachexia syndrome, when you have the muscle wasting, and then they go into a coma and are non-responsive right before they die. And this is mostly what you see in when I was in the hospice, you know, that we would see patients who would stop eating, and then they would go into a coma and become unresponsive, and then they would die. And cancer patients are more likely to die at home because they have that predictable trajectory, more predictable than other trajectories. So you can kind of estimate a little bit better when somebody might be getting closer to dying and make that transition to hospice care if that's what they want. Are you all familiar with the palliative performance scale? I don't know if that was when I worked in hospice. We had to, every time we went to see a patient, give them a PPS, a scale number. And that's part of your handouts too. So it talks about 100% PPS is somebody who is completely functional. So in all activities of daily living, they can get in and out of the chair, they can eat, they can take care of themselves. And then somebody who, it's 10% PPS, and they're totally bedbound. They're unable to do any work. They are drowsy or in a coma. And so you assess people between those and according to how they're declining. And that helps know, you know, in hospice as a team, if we saw that somebody went from a 40% PPS where they had some ability to now they're 30% PPS, they can't get out of bed anymore, we know that there is a big change, and so that we would increase our visits and services, and that was, you know, document all of that. But for cancer patients, this is really helpful because it does seem to match what the progression is usually like. And so you can see when somebody went from a 40 to a 30% then to a 20% that they are really getting closer to death. And you could kind of prepare the family and prepare the team and make a plan for how we were going to support them. For other diseases, it's not always that. It's not that helpful. But it does help you figure out where somebody is in the disease progression. And this is another just FYI interesting thing to see that I borrowed from another doctor's presentation. And it's how symptoms at the end of life differ between cancer patients and other kinds of causes of death. So that's from a study in 94, so it's a little old. But you can see how in cancer patients there's more pain, more depression, a little bit more. More loss of appetite, pressure ulcers, incontinence, and sleeplessness. The only things that seem to be less would be confusion and I guess maybe a little bit less trouble breathing. All right. Now for non-cancer patients, it's a little more difficult to prognosticate. So when somebody has a terminal diagnosis that is not cancer, it's a little more difficult to know when they're eligible for hospice. But hospice eligibility guidelines for cancer non-cancer patients include that they do have a life-limiting illness and that they've chosen a palliative route rather than a disease-modifying or a curative treatment. And they have to have documented evidence of progressive decline, which may, or progressive disease, which may include functional decline or nutritional status, decline in nutritional status in the previous 6 months. So if they're not been eating a lot or losing a lot of weight. But you all know when there is somebody who's been diagnosed, my dad was diagnosed with ALS in 2009. And, you know, the news you get when somebody is diagnosed with ALS is the most people, the life expectancy is 2 to 5 years. And so now we're in 2016. So it's been, and he's kind of been in the stable, not, well, kind of been in the same, trying to find the words here. It's been moving progressively for him, but it's low, a lot slower than we anticipated. It's just hard for diseases that are not exactly, don't follow that trajectory as closely as the cancer trajectories do. Do y'all have any comments about your experience with this so far? Jump in anytime. Okay, so what might, considering all of this for that terminal illness trajectory, what might be the spiritual needs and interventions? And this is, again, where you all might help us brainstorm too. But the first one being, you know, especially if you're given the diagnosis of advanced cancer, ALS, if it's a terminal diagnosis that they know for sure this is going to eventually take my life, there is that shock that of diagnosis, the loss, anticipated plans and dreams and despair and you know all of this. I don't have to tell you. But that is, there are studies to back that up that say that the spiritual, there's one study in the Palliative Medicine Journal, and it studied the needs, the spiritual needs of lung cancer and heart patients. And it said that for those who had lung cancer, patients and caregivers, their needs were characterized by despair associated with facing the serious illness and death, punctuated by episodes of hope when they felt better and they were able to have a positive outlook. But the biggest need that I have seen in the studies that I have looked at and also in the patients that I have encountered in the hospital and hospice side has been this, demoralization, just loss of meaning, loss of a sense of identity, sense of hope. And this, there are so many studies out there about this, especially with cancer patients. And I picked a couple that seems really interesting and that taught me something this last year to share with you today. So one of them was, it was a review of cancer patients' experiences of spiritual or existential suffering towards the end of life. And it said that, of course, feeling like you're a burden to others and a loss of dignity were big parts of suffering in cancer patients, and also the desire for death or a loss of will to live. And a lot of that was just feeling that I am needing to take help from other people, but I'm unable to give anything back. That came out through those studies. And there are a couple quotes here that help illustrate that. And this, these quotes actually I pulled out from one article of one of the studies that I looked at, and where this patient says, if only I could express myself, I could get lectures, I could do lots of things, but I just sit here being an unnecessary. Well, then it's easy to develop a desire for death, feeling unnecessary or not needed anymore. And this one from another patient, I went out with Anita watching birds, and I said, oh, I need to pee. So I walked out of the bird hide, stood there, and then I peed. But then, I'll just say it, I suddenly pooped too. Then I deeply, deeply cried, standing there outside in nature. I became intensely sad. I don't know, I burst into tears. I felt so sad about this happening to me. I had no control at all. It just happened without my involvement. And just that loss of dignity, which I have heard Dr. Chachanov is one of the authors of one of the studies that I looked at, and I've heard a lecture that he gave one time, and he called it the intimates of care, or the intimacy of care, something like that, is when you're talking about toileting, helping somebody use the toilet, bathing, those kinds of things that are so intimate, and how that has the potential for people to feel a loss of dignity and a loss of meaning, having to depend on others for that. All right, so here's where we're getting into a little bit more into the other studies that were possibly surprising. So one study showed that feeling like a burden in terminal cancer patients, 60%, majority of them indicated varying degrees of burden-related distress, with 23% of those scoring that within the highest quartile of distress. So a big, big need for advanced cancer patients. But this was surprising to me that aside from fatigue and appearance, other physical issues, whether it's dyspnea, nausea, appetite, pain, they were not significantly associated with a sense of burden, feeling like a sense of burden to others. So other things that were not related. Satisfaction from social support did not correlate significantly with their sense of being a burden to others. And also the level, and this is the most surprising part to me, their actual functional status did not correlate significantly with their sense of feeling like a burden to others. And I'm trying to say this a little more eloquently right now. But basically what the study is saying is that it doesn't matter how functional those people are. You might think that somebody who is completely bedbound will feel more like a burden than somebody who just lost their ability to drive, for instance. But that doesn't really predict. Your level of functional dependence doesn't predict how much you're going to feel like a burden. It really has to do with your outlook and how they're able to see themselves. And the most significant correlations seen between sense of burden and hopelessness was depression and outlook. So for this study, and I see, make sure that is the same study because there were a couple that were similar, it said that if those people who view themselves as having lost value, having lost intrinsic meaning in life, were more likely to perceive that other people saw themselves the same way. And so whether they were still, you know, pretty functional or not, if they already felt like, well, if I can't drive, then I have no value or I have no meaning anymore in my life or whatever it is, then they perceived that others were also looking at them the same way as this unnecessary burden, and they were more likely to feel like a burden. I mean, it makes sense once you think about it, but it surprised me that – did you have something to add? Go ahead.
I can actually give – I'm Laura Manis, and I am a staff – well, a lead chaplain. I also do palliative care. But I see this as a big big spiritual need with my patients that are going through this, but I'm also actually having to go through it as a daughter with my father. He has been diagnosed with dementia, and so we're seeing the progression. And this past year, he's been in the hospital several times due to the fact that his progression of dementia has been accelerated by anesthesia. So he had to have a surgery, and so we're watching it go very quickly at this point. But every time I've gone home to see them, and I'm not in the same city, so that is very hard for me, every time I see him and his abilities of just simple things, he's not able to drive anymore. He's not able to do some things, but his hopelessness and his sense of burden, I don't want to feel like a burden, is said almost daily.
Is it Alice?
Elisa.
You made a comment earlier about, just a moment ago, about when the patient begins seeing themselves as with hopelessness, they see themselves as not worth much, then they start projecting that others see them that way too. What I would add to that is that those of us who have dealt with depression over the years do the same thing without having that physical decline, that when we see ourselves as not worth much, then we project that same feeling on others, that cycle can be there. So again, kind of reinforcing that that would be the case, we see that with folks who are not dealing with terminal illnesses as well.
Thank you. That's a good point.
You have a
yes,
comment?
Go ahead, please.
I may be jumping the gun, but I'm just wondering about research done about the point at the time in which patients actually give up. Because I've seen some patients give up where they have a relative, you know, an uncertain amount of time left, and others give up and then they immediately die. Mm-hmm. And I just find there's a spiritual nature to this. I think it varies a little bit depending on the faith mm-hmm. that a patient has. Anyway, it prompted me to think about that. I'm just wondering if there's anything you know about it.
I don't know that there's any. I haven't run across any research about in how to define that give up or in how what factors determine that. But I think it is a good point because I do think that it's a difficult thing for oncologists in particular to talk with patients about realistic outcomes and expectations for treatments and all of those things because they're so afraid that their patients are going to give up and lose hope. So, I heard that all the time when I worked in hospice because it was families would say, we would really benefit from this service, from the team support, from the medicines, from the care at home. But we're so afraid that when we tell Dad about that he's a hospice patient, that he's going to give up. And it's, I don't know, does anybody want to comment on that? It's a hard line, I guess. It's a hard balance because we always try to present hospice in particular as a hopeful, you know, you don't want to. I'm sorry, go ahead. You may have other things to say.
I just have a personal note on that in that when a best friend was dying, his wife had us all praying for hope, and then she suddenly realized that she said, oh, but I was using my definition of hope. And I forgot that there's always hope, mm-hmm. even when you are mm-hmm. accepting your impending death. Mm-hmm. And that I've used that a lot in hospice work.
That's pretty good. Yeah, and we'll come back to that a little bit later while we're still talking about terminal illness. So hold on to that. So in the studies, it showed that patients who have that fear of being a burden, they were most concerned about the burden related to the provision of physical care, especially the toiletrine and all that, but also of their families witnessing their death and their families having to make decisions for them at the end of life, especially related to life support. And there was a study that contrasted. It looked at several studies of, so it was a literature review about demoralization studies, and it found that demoralization differs from depression a little bit, but it's a hard nuance to balance. And what they said in that study is that the core symptoms of depression include a loss of pleasure and interest in the present moment, whereas the core symptoms of demoralization are a loss of hope and meaning with a loss of anticipatory pleasure rather than just a loss of general ability to take pleasure in the moment, the loss of anticipatory pleasure and loss of hope and meaning. I don't know if that helps a little or not. Yes.
Just a little comment, maybe a little crowdsourcing here. Something I've run into recently, switching from pediatrics to more adult care, that idea of the demoralization of the patient, them not wanting to witness, have their family and loved ones witness their death. And I was wondering if anybody else had come across, a lot of times family members are upset with themselves for not being present mm-hmm. at the actual moment of death. Mm-hmm. And that's, to me, I've found it to be part of the grieving process and them mm-hmm. and so on, but it was just, that struck me mm-hmm. as something the patient doesn't want you to be there mm-hmm. sometimes, but the family really kind of beats themselves up for not being there at the moment of death. I had a recent mm-hmm. situation like that.
I think that's very true. I can't tell you. I can think of a few examples where somebody was there the whole time, and then they left to go to the bathroom. That's when this patient died, and it's, you know, you feel like they probably meant it that way.
Yeah.
You know?
I used to be a hospice chaplain. And I was amazed at how many times the kids, especially kids, would be at a vigil. And they'd just get up to go get a cup of coffee or use the restroom, and that's when the patient would expire. And I don't know if this was comforting, but at times what I would say to the children is I would say, you know, maybe that was your mom or dad's parting gift. Is that they couldn't go when you were in the room. You know, they didn't want you to see that. They couldn't go with your love in the room. And that seemed to comfort them. I don't know if it was true, but I know my mom is 87, and she's told me that. She says, I don't want you to see me die. So I don't know if there's any truth to it, but it happens so often.
I think we can't explain it. Yeah.
And I have a lot of stories like that where, they days.
Yeah.
And I'm a-coming.
I think what we're talking about on both sides is a loss of control. So the patient mm-hmm. wants to control who's going to be there, how it's going to be there, the family member who's grieving. It's the loss of control. Mm-hmm. So it's not the actual act of whether I was there or not. It was the having to accept the loss of control throughout the whole thing. And then another comment, sometimes the one I use is, they couldn't say goodbye to you. That's the phrase I'll use to say they had to die because they just, it was too hard for them to say goodbye to you. And that sometimes is helpful.
This dialogue just triggered a couple things for me, and I was thinking about the idea of one of the things we talk about is the idea of either giving or receiving permission to die. Mm-hmm. Again, you use the word mystery. And I liked that. It's that unexplainable thing that happens. And I know that I watch it unfold, the lack of control, the mystery, and maybe I'm not meant to explain it, but that idea of having permission to die when we do those compassionate extubations and then the person kind of lingers mm-hmm. and then they get kind of the guilt of stuff. And anyway, it's dumbfounding to me.
Yeah, sometimes I'll ask families, well, were they like when they were healthy, when they're themselves? Did they like a lot of people around? Were they more private? And people like to die how they lived a lot of times. And sometimes I'll say, well, maybe that was their way of still taking care of you, protecting you. Or maybe that's how, yes. And sometimes it's helpful, I think, to think about the metaphor of giving birth. You know, when you're waiting for a child to be born and you don't have the control of how it's going to happen, when it's going to happen. And but there are people waiting on both sides, waiting on the other side to welcome them. And I kind of try to use that imagery sometimes. This was another study that was really interesting to me, and it was about demoralization and the desire to hasten death. And it would be interesting to look at states where, like Oregon, where you might have a little more research about people who choose to hasten that death versus places where you can't. You just have that desire. But the study found that things that were correlated with the desire to hasten death, so one was cancer pain severity. Again, it was with cancer patients. So cancer pain severity, the pain interference with function, how much the pain was interfering with their ability to do daily living. Depression, perceived absence of social support, lower levels of physical functioning that go with the pain interference. Okay. So then in this study, they looked at the patients who had all of those things, and they worked really hard to get their pain reduced. And so over the course of a month, they treated the pain so that the pain would be less and so that the pain would not interfere as much with the people's ability to function. And after a month, they looked, and the pain had reduced. The pain was not interfering as much with their function, and yet that did not decrease the desire to hasten death. Like they were expecting to. This was surprising to the researchers. They were expecting that would then make the people have less of a desire to hasten death, but that didn't happen. But the other surprising thing that happened was that the one independently predictive thing to decrease in patients' desire for hasten death was improvement in depression. That's what got that desire to hasten death to decrease, was if they had any improvement in their depression. So, again, it goes back to that outlook, whether people are functional or not, whether they're in pain or not. Yes, it matters. Obviously, it does influence and affect their quality of life and meaning and hope and desire to will to live and all of that. But it's really about that internal outlook and perspective. That's what matters most. And that's what we do, folks. I mean, we're right there in the... where we can make a lot of difference. I mean, okay, so some other needs, spiritual needs for people in the terminal illness trajectory. It may be difficulty making decisions regarding treatments, and this goes back to what was said before about when people are afraid to give up when people might have some inappropriate, what we call futile treatment at the end of life. And there was a study that looked at four commonly invoked reasons for inappropriate treatment at the end of life, one being hope for a miracle, refusal to give up on the God of faith, conviction that every moment of life is worth preserving at any cost, and belief that suffering can have a redemptive value. And I would add, I mean, I've not done any studies, but just in the area where I worked with is southeastern rural Kentucky. There's also this, I think, part of it is a paternalistic kind of medicine where this is what the doctor says. This is the treatment that we do. This is how it goes. And there's no other alternative. But also sometimes like a fatalistic perspective that says, this is how it goes. If you stop eating, you get a feeding tube, and there's just no question of how – there's no alternative story. There's no question about is this appropriate or not. It's just this is how it goes, and there's nothing that you can do to make it any different. I get that a lot, or we see that a lot with the patients that we see, especially in palliative care at the hospital, where they've never thought – you know, they're saying, for instance, and I'm not saying this would be appropriate for every patient, but say there's a patient who has been having dialysis for years and years and years, and their life revolves around dialysis. And this is another trajectory, but still, it comes, I think, into play here. And all they do is be there for dialysis, and they feel horrible when they're not in dialysis. They feel like they have no quality of life. They hate it. But they've never once, ever, once thought to, do I want to stop dialysis? Because it doesn't ever occur to them that that's an alternative, that's a possibility. Nobody has ever presented to them as a question. It's just, this is what you got to do. And also, there is this imagery, really strong imagery out there about fighting cancer. And the way that it's usually portrayed is you have to have these treatments to fight cancer. And if you don't do the treatments, then you're not fighting, you're giving up. And that's, and then it puts the pressure on people, I feel like, to be the fighter image and not, even if they don't want to go that route with the treatments or whatever it may be. So this is a quote from a patient that says, don't lie down, get up and fight it, because it can be beat, and you're the only person that can beat it. And you see this. I mean, I know you've encountered a lot of patients and people who feel like you, if you stop any kind of aggressive or curative treatment, that then you are giving up and you are choosing not to care. I remember I have two things in my mind right now. One is a real patient who was a young woman in her 20s, dying of cancer, had two small children, and she was in a lot of pain, but we couldn't really treat her pain very well because she was still wanting to get these chemotherapy treatments because she so desperately wanted to be there for her children when they grow up. I mean, who can blame her? But to getting these treatments, she had a lot of the pain, and she had a very little energy, and so she couldn't spend any time with the kids. She couldn't hold them. She couldn't play with them. She, even if when they were around, it stressed her out because she wasn't taking care of them. You know, she had a little 2-year-old, and she would be trying to get mommy to pick me up and do things, and she felt so guilty. She couldn't even be around them, and so you can just imagine the suffering that she was in. And I remember this one big meeting we had, and the palliative care team was there, so I was there, and then the oncologist, her nurse, the primary team, the social work, I mean, there was a lot of people and her family, and we were talking to her. She also had to have, she was also at the point trying to make a decision about whether to have dialysis or not because her kidneys were failing. And she was saying, and she sat in the room, oh, but I, because the doctor, the oncologist was saying, at this point, these treatments are not going to be helpful. But she was still helping, letting her make the decision. And this is a very simplification of that whole conversation. But I remember the patient saying, yes, but I'm afraid, I don't want to give up. And so in instances like that, I have found it helpful sometimes to say to folks, well, no matter what we choose, no matter what decision we make, we're always giving something up in favor of something else. So if you continue the route you're doing, but then you're also giving up some other things in favor of that hope for cure, where if you choose to give that up, you're also gaining other things. So what, you know, sometimes it's, and I said it a little more pastoral than that, but sometimes, you know, it's helpful to help people understand that yes, you're giving up on something, but in favor of something else. So what are you giving up, and what are you gaining, and what is more important for you to gain at this point? And she just died like a couple days after that. It was very sad. The other thing that was playing in my mind is a fictional character, and this was, has anybody ever watched Private Practice TV show? Okay, good. I have somebody. I used to love that show. And they had, it was a spin off of, the famous Grey's Anatomy. And so they had a holistic practice with no chaplain. They never called the chaplain for anything. I don't know how holistic that was. But they had, in the show, there was a patient who had cancer, and she was also a young mother. So I guess that's why those are both in my mind. Because that show really got me riled up. So she was a young mom. Well, she had an 8-year-old son in the show, and her ex-husband was a physician who was part of the practice, and she had brain cancer, and she had decided that she didn't want to do treatment. She wanted to spend time with her son, who was Mason. She wanted to spend all of her time with him and have quality of life and focus on that. She didn't want to go through the treatments, and this was driving her ex-husband, the physician, crazy, and he was having a very hard time with that. But I remember this one conversation that he had with the ex-wife who had the brain cancer, and this is what upset me, and this is what I think patients hear all the time. You need to do these treatments because you need to show Mason that you care, and you need to show him that you're brave and that you're strong and that you care about him, and who knows, you may get lucky. And I remember watching that show and thinking, stop saying that to people. And eventually, I think in the show, she did choose to have treatments because of that. And that's fine. I mean, if you choose that, that's fine. But don't put the pressure on people, too. And I feel like that's... I'm sorry?
That sounded like almost a guilt trip.
Yes. But that's what people get from the media and sometimes from family and from doctors and everything else. I'm sorry? Go easy on the doctors. I'm sorry. No, we have great doctors. So the oncologist in my real story was wonderful in that room.
Just can I stand up? You don't care if I stand. I'm Bill Holmes. I'm a retired child neurologist. I did that for 37 years. So you know, I said, why am I doing this now? Mainly because I would show up in the ER at Children's in Louisville at 2 in the morning when one of my patients was dying, and there stood a chaplain. He beat me there. I showed up at 4 a.m. for a brain tumor patient dying in the ICU, and there stood the grief chaplain. Rick was there. And then in December or January of 2010, I had bladder cancer and prostate cancer separate within a short time, and there stood a chaplain. And 18 months later, I had colon cancer, and there stood a chaplain. There is a woman. We have our director there is the chaplain to the chaplains, I believe. So it wasn't a hard decision. But one thing I've learned, because I'm looking at, it's hard to sometimes shut off the medical mind and draw the line. But so they blend together, but I keep my medical mouth shut. I do, really. But there is, we insert ourselves into somebody's life at the most crucial time. And it's sometimes hard to evaluate how much to say and not to say. And you raised the question of hope. In my library, the longest shelf is a book. And I only read in medicine, if there's a lot of things written on something, it's because we don't know anything about it. And in hope, it's just the longest shelf. And how does one... Because a lot of times it's medical hope we're talking about. It's not... It has nothing to do with our theology. Sometimes we forget that. And I love that you brought up this part about the fight. How often do we hear, and I've heard it in practice, doctor, you've got to make them eat. Well, they're dying. You don't need food, but they know it. There's something your brain tells you, and it makes a big difference in how you handle things. I made some notes here, but I'm going to throw these away because they're not going to really. The idea, though, that just to stress how important it is, from my viewpoint, both from the standpoint of someone who practices medicine, is to have someone there who represents God or whoever, what a person's idea of God is. And it doesn't make any difference where they're coming from. But at first, it may not seem like anything to you, but in the long run, it is so memorable because people will say, I remember you coming. The futility issues that come up, and this will be the last thing, is some of our chaplains once got upset because the intensivist told the family any further treatment is futile. Well, he was referring to medical treatment. He did not mean there's not something yet to be done. We're very fortunate in that our intensivists and our neurosurgeons, the chaplains know them when they walk into the room with them and they hear everything that's said. So it's been that notion of futility, and then where does one bring up hope and what is it? And we all get that figured out. Would you take my email and send me your message on hope? I would like to have it. So.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I know I'm conscious of time. This was the biggest because there's so many studies on cancer, and this was the biggest part of the presentation. The other trajectories won't take as long, but we'll have to move quickly. So some of the interventions that may be helpful, of course, meaning making interventions like dignity therapy, and also, let me see if we find my page here, life review, and also modeling how to treat people with dignity. You know that sometimes you go into a room and you see the family or the nurse or the, you know, therapist or whatever using baby talk to talk to the patient. And it's, you can, you know, first I remember what my grandfather-in-law, was his well-respected, gentleman. Everybody called him Mr. Ashley. He, you know, carried himself really properly. And then he went to the hospital. He had cancer. And I remember as a family member feeling upset when the nurse came in and said, "Hey, baby, can I change your IV or whatever?" And I remember thinking, this does not sound good to him, I'm sure, because he's not used to being treated this way. And who likes to be treated this way? So sometimes just modeling for folks how to address the patient with still dignity. Helping decrease isolation in some of those studies about demoralization, it did show that when patients were able to talk to their families about feeling like they were a burden or about feeling that their life didn't have value anymore, that it did help alleviate some of that. So encouraging, or at least just being there for them as chaplains, help them feel that somebody understands and they're not as isolated. And perhaps encouraging, you know, helping family understand how they might feel and normalizing some of that. Not telling you anything new, I know that. Advanced care planning, of course, because especially since that study showed that one of the biggest things that people fear when they fear being a burden is having their families make decisions for them at the end of life. Well, that is easy to fix, you know, somewhat. It's something that we can help them with. And advanced care planning, if you're the pastoral care department in your hospital, if you don't take active steps in being part of the advanced care planning conversation, I encourage you to, because that is, I have found that to be very helpful and meaningful in the hospitals where I worked, where actually in both where I did my residency and now where I work, we are notaries because of that, because we can help. Are you too? That's great. Because we can help guide folks through that conversation and then go ahead and notarize their living will, which is really helpful. And then, you know, when we talked about the fighter image, which may be appropriate, what other imagery is there for cancer? How else can we talk about living with cancer or even fighting cancer? That's maybe a different way to rephrase that, or to tell a different story. So if the story that's playing in the patient's mind is, if I stop this treatment, I have given up. Okay, how else can we tell that story? How can we rephrase that so that, you know, they're able to make decisions that they want to make rather than having that guilt? Anything else before we move to organ failure? Go ahead.
I'm going to give a running imagery kind of thing here. When we give interventions, sometimes the patient or the family might think they're very scary or very painful. Maybe re-imagery, they're talking about something painful. We might have to actually, I don't want to say cause pain, but do an intervention that will lead to more healing down the road. spiritual healing, emotional healing. In the running world or in the healing world, has anybody heard of a Rosti therapy? It's similar to chiropractic, but it was muscles. I had to go through it last month with something, and he would pinpoint a trigger point and push very, very hard on it for it felt like a long time, and I kept on telling Dr. Tremere, and that's the doctor, he knew I was a chaplain, and I said, how many people have told you they want to die going through these interventions to stop this pain? I said, I'm not suicidal, but I really want to die. And he started laughing. He goes, do you need a chaplain? And so now he actually sends me patients of his, but he works through patients with cancer, especially that are going through chemo. And he works the muscles, works that that poison out of the body so healing can happen in different ways. So the healing that happened for me was I was having headaches, and people thought, oh, it's stress. It's always stress for chaplains. But actually mine was a big knot in one of my muscles in my neck, and he got it out, and I've had no headaches. But it was very painful. So the interventions that we do as chaplains sometimes of trying to re-image, bring something out that might be painful for the family is actually going to cause more healing in the long term in the course of the illness.
I hadn't thought about it that way, but I think I might do that, sort of, kind of. I do something kind of strange, which is, and I've learned that I've been a chaplain for a long time, and I used to really dread going into rooms where people had new diagnosis, because I think I went in as the sad chaplain, you know, like the, oh, I'm so sorry, or you've got a bad diagnosis. And I realized that by doing that, I put my stuff on them. So now I try to go in more as a, without any effect, just to kind of see, so I can see how they're reacting to their diagnosis, which is how we should be doing it anyway. I know, so don't, you know. And what I've learned from that is that the variety of experiences they bring to a diagnosis sometimes is surprising. And when you were saying that some people want to die, some elderly patients are almost relieved that they now know how the story is going to end. And I've been really surprised by that. And so what I will do with that information is I will say, okay, now that we know how the story is going to end, what are you sad about that you're going to miss? And they can kind of walk through what they're going to miss, and we can kind of strategize what that means to not be there. And is there something that they can do, like write a letter for their granddaughter on her wedding day? Or what are the 10 top things that you hope your grandkids will know once you're gone? Or life lessons or something like that. But I hadn't looked at it as that before, and that's very helpful.
That's a great comment. Thank you. Okay, so for organ failure, if you remember, this is a trajectory that was like this, up and down, and when you recover from a crisis, they may not get all the way up to where they were before, so they're a little bit less, but functional, and then they have another crisis, and they recover, another, and recover. So it's a fluctuating pattern of functional decline. Does usually have poor functioning the last 3 months prior to death. However, the death may be sudden. It's usually unexpected. A lot of times it's just another crisis that cannot be treated, but you don't quite know if this is just going to be another crisis or is this going to be the end. So a lot of acute admissions, frequent hospitalizations. And I found, let me go back. Okay. There was a study about the heart patients and the lung cancer patients that was examining their needs. And this was interesting that for those heart patients who came to the hospital a lot of them talked about feeling abandoned by the healthcare team because they felt like when they kept coming back that people treated them like there's nothing more we can do for you, like they were just, you know, another, I guess I want to say a burden, even though they didn't say that. but that they seem to feel abandoned by the health and social care services in the community. And they also talked about their spiritual needs not being recognized by the staff. And one quote from a patient said, "The staff are too busy. You have to learn to look out for yourself. You just have to adapt. I try to hide my grief and be nice to others." That's what they want to see, someone coming in who's cheerful and doesn't complain. And so in this study, they actually said that some services like chaplaincy were underutilized for folks with organ failure, but they were greatly appreciated if used. You know, people just don't know. They don't take the initiative to ask for a chaplain or really even know how they can benefit from a chaplain visit. But those who have the frequent admissions over a long period of time. For them, it's more difficult to prognosticate, like I said before, because you don't quite know how long the progression is going to be. But an independent marker of the imminence of death in the literature review is social withdrawal. Which is, so, yes, go ahead.
Yeah, this just reminded me of how important the interaction is with a family. Mm-hmm. Because in the organ failure example, you know, with the repeated admissions, mm-hmm. on many times I've found that the patient may have a clearer understanding of where they are than the family does.
That's true.
And there can be very unrealistic expectations of the family, because in the cycle, you know, their thoughts may be, well, he recovered last time, so he'll recover this time.
Correct.
Which may be completely false.
And I think even as a healthcare team, we're that way, you know. But sometimes I've heard patients in the hospital saying, "I don't think I'm getting out of this alive. I don't think I'm recovering from this." So then I go back and I ask the nurse and say, "They're saying this. What do you think?" They're like, "Well, I think there is just the same as they've always." You know, it's just everybody, we all feel like, "I don't see it." But maybe that's that internal, maybe when you've had enough too. I don't know. But I've learned to pay attention when people tell me that. "I think I'm dying," even if all, you know, the vital signs and everything look okay. Interesting. This was a comment that the doctor on my team made that made a lot of sense to me. And she said that because the progression is so prolonged for patients who have organ failure, that it may almost be like a silent illness. I mean, you know they're sick. They may be carrying an oxygen tank, you know, maybe wearing oxygen all the time. But they've done this for years and years. How many times do you see an event for COPD awareness or fundraising or shirts for COPD or when you go to a church meeting and you say, "Let's pray for so-and-so who has COPD"? It's usually the cancer diagnoses that get the prayer requests. It's the cancer that gets all the awareness and fundraisers and everything else. The sex and diseases. Right. How many people are contributing to find a cure for COPD or whatever? So they may feel the suffering that they may have may be a little invisible to the rest of us because it's been going on behind the doors and we don't pay attention to it as much. So the study that examined heart patients and lung cancer patients, for the spiritual needs of heart patients and their caregivers, what characterized it was hopelessness, isolation, and altered self-image associated with the chronic illness and disability. And that self-image, you can see how that, we've already talked to that. When you live with a disease for so long, sure, that's going to affect your self-image. Difficulty preparing for death, yes, because of what you all just mentioned. How can you know, how does the family prepare when they feel like they're just going to bounce back just like they always have or like they have before, or even the patient may feel that themselves. And then there are specific spiritual needs that are related to specific diseases. So we know, and there are studies that relate heart disease to depression and fatigue, and COPD to anxiety. And you might be able to think of some others that are very closely related depending on, so you can pretty much guess if you're going to see a COPD patient that they may be dealing with some anxiety and heart disease, that they may be dealing with some fatigue and depression. And I like this quote about fatigue because we don't always, I think about fatigue as much as we do pain and other physical symptoms. But listen to this as this patient tells it. Fatigue gives me a pain that can be compared with carrying a very, very heavy bag of cement on my shoulders. You know, a bag of Portland weighing 50 kilos all day, anywhere, and anytime. I wake up with it. I go to sleep with it. But I have learned to downplay it to a certain extent. It is a deadly fatigue, a painful feeling of being dead tired. Very heavy fatigue. It is pain. It's so extremely heavy. And how, you know, you see people who are dealing with fatigue, and I don't know that I always am aware of how much that may be impacting them. So I have advanced care plan on all of these interventions, just so you know. But that is important for patients with organ failure because it is so difficult to know when death is closer or imminent than it might be for somebody who has a cancer, advanced cancer diagnosis. But it is very important for then to, I can tell you, you know, there have been times when I have seen a patient in the hospital and I wanted to ask them about life support because I thought they might be intubated again. Maybe they've been before, but I don't know if it's quite the right time. And then the next day I come back to work, they're on the vent. It's like, you know, and that happens. And I have regretted before not bringing up advanced care planning. I don't know that I've regretted not bringing it. I mean, you don't push it on people, obviously. But it is a good idea to present it early, to help folks talk about it early, because there have been times when I have seen people, their treatment take a course that I'm not quite sure that's what they wanted because we have not talked about it. Because it's hard to know when it's the right time. Sure is. Very helpful for patients and families if they are able to make some plans. Legacy making. Some of you have already talked about that. Writing letters to family and think about how they want to be remembered and what they want to leave, what values they want to pass to their families. And also for those who have the anxiety, pain, fatigue, other kinds of physical symptoms that are also related to spiritual needs, and it may be helpful to have some other integrative therapies that we can either provide as chaplains or we can collaborate with other people in the hospital to provide that, like guided imagery or music, maybe even massage. And healing touch, Reiki, those kinds of things, they do help. Contemplative practices with those kinds of needs. Social support, because like this goes back to them might be feeling invisible. One thing that we have started at our hospital recently, we're just in the beginning phase of that, but it's a congregational health network or a network for healthcare. We're working on the name. Where we are going to enlist churches to partner with the hospital so that if their members decide to become part of the network, when they're in the hospital, we're going to activate communication with the church volunteers so that they are able to provide visits to the patient in the hospital, but also once they're discharged, have a plan of care for the church to follow. So do they need visits? Do they need phone calls? Do they need help with groceries? Do they need transportation to appointments? Do they need reminders to take their medicines, whatnot. So we're hoping that this is going to help people reduce the frequent readmissions, but also just enhance the care of the patient. But there are other places that utilize a lot of volunteers. Like they have the 11th hour volunteers, nobody dies alone kind of programs. We don't have that at my hospital. And some other ways that you might be creative about thinking how to integrate those people or provide them with some support. Does anybody do something interesting they want to share? And chaplain initiative visits, because remember that those people are going to be in and out of the hospital, and they're not likely to call for a chaplain, but they're likely, very likely to benefit from a chaplain visit if we're able to see them. Okay. Yes, go ahead, please.
First, I personally think dying is a bad idea. And me dying is even a worse idea. In 2002, I had heart valve surgery, and the heart surgeon's nurse came out and said, here's 10 things that could go wrong, the last one being death. And then I woke up on the ventilator and realized 9 out of 10 had happened. And you know, if you ever want to, the major, if you ever been in an open heart recovery unit where the, all the just curtains between, and you realize it's the biggest HIPAA violation in the world, if you're conscious. And I was conscious enough to know, and I was sitting there, lying there, listening, strapped down to a gurney with a tube in my throat, and somebody yelled, fib flutter, which means you're going into heart failure, bed 10. And I looked up, and I was bed 10. But it was a long night. It was one of those times that I finally realized what the psalmist meant when he said, how long, O Lord, how long? Or my God, why have you forsaken me? And the Psalms of Lament. One of my privileges the last half a dozen years has been being a friend with Walter Brueggemann. As you know, he writes copiously on the Psalms. And I wrote some of my stories and gave them to him. He said, basically, as chaplains, you are the Psalms on the ground. You're presenting that people are yelling out, and you are there to hear it. And that's why I love the Psalms, and love especially the Psalms of Lament, because it expresses from a gut level what you, in fact, may be feeling. And it presents to me the biggest reason to be there for people who are facing death, because they have questions that they might not even know the words to answer the question. But there's nothing more terrifying to know that somewhere in your body there are cells multiplying at a very rapid rate, and they're going to have to do bad things to you to stop them. You got to decide which bad things you're going to let happen. And so that's it.
So moving on to the frailty, post-stroke dementia trajectory, which is the one that's closer to the bottom but slower progression. Folks are relatively more functionally disabled, so less functional, throughout the final year of death. There are fewer prognostic markers. It's a long gradual decline, usually very poor health state, culminating in death at an unpredictable time, which may follow infection or some other acute problem, or may have no obvious cause. And those who are impaired for at least 12 months before death are more likely to die in a nursing home. And just an FYI, I ran into a study that said that 44% of deaths in American nursing homes and 35% of deaths in long-term care facilities in the United Kingdom occurred within 1 year of admission. I was surprised by that. There was a study that looked at, the name of the study was Awareness of Impending Death for Residents of Long-Term Care Facilities in 2014. And it showed that a serious decline towards death in the elderly in nursing homes was not noticed or not acknowledged by staff or family until the last few hours or days of life. So then palliative care was limited to late-stage pain management. And this seems common. A lot of times families will say, well, I thought that they would tell me when they were getting ready, that the staff would tell me when my mom was getting ready to die or when death was getting closer, but they never told me. Or maybe it was missed or wasn't, people weren't aware or I don't know what happens. But a lot of times it is hard to recognize that time. So in this study, they asked residents and they asked family and staff about what were the early signs. Now that you look back or when you look around, what were the early signs of impending death? And some of the early signs that they reported were declining participation in social activities, less of a zest for life, disinterest in or reduced intake of food, fluids, more time spent in bed, and speaking or dreaming of predecessors. And then some of the signs that death was even closer, The reported signs were changes in breathing patterns, decreased level of consciousness, abnormal body temperature, and mottling of the extremities, which is when skin gets patchy and purple. And this was similar to another study that looked at, let me see what this one called. This was called Diagnosing Dying, an Integrative Literature Review, also in 2014, and looked about the physical and the behavioral indicators of death in the frail elderly. And so the physical indicators were anorexia, loss of appetite, increased pain, greater weakness, frailty, weight loss, altered breathing patterns, mottled skin, and distinctive odor. So you can see some similarities there. Some of the behavioral indicators of death were personality and mood changes, new tendency to decline social interactions. So you see the social withdrawal there again, increased restlessness, agitation, or anxiety. That is, especially as people got closer to death, they saw, a lot of times we'll see the terminal agitation. So this is when, well, we'll move on to the knees unless anybody has a comment. So one of the biggest spiritual needs that people who are struggling with dementia or post-stroke or who are in that frailty trajectory might have is loneliness, because especially if they've moved to a nursing home, well, not always, but or just from the fact of having an advanced age, not having the bonds that they once had. So listen to this. Did I put the quote there? Yes. I feel like a sawed-off tree, completely sawed off. But a sawed-off tree still has roots. I have no roots anymore, no strong bonds anymore, no close connection to life anymore. Of course, I value those bonds. But hey, you fall in love, you get married, you have a living apart together relationship. Well, that's it. That's as far as it goes. It's a gilded edge, a nice dessert, but it's not something to keep you alive. It's interesting to think I have no roots anymore and how that may be true for a lot of people. Another one may be memory loss, difficulty connecting with others if people have dementia or maybe are not even verbal anymore, and the loss of roles and loss of sense of identity and sense of self that goes along with that. Also, uncertainty about what is the appropriate balance. This is especially for family members if the patients don't have capacity to make decisions anymore. When do we stop aggressive curative treatment? When do we introduce palliative goals of care, comfort care measures only? What is the proper balance of restorative treatments? And, you know, it's, we see that a lot of sometimes when we have folks coming back from the nursing home to the hospital with their family, trying to decide what is the appropriate plan of care for them, because it's not clear. These are the patients that when we talked about the PPS scale that we talked about before, the palliative performance scale, they may be on that 30% PPS where you're totally bedbound, may or may not be confused, may eat a little, but not able to do a lot for self. They may be on that 30% PPS for years. In fact, when I started hospice, Medicare requirements were a little different. Right now, when I left hospice care, they had changed the requirements to where we have to have documented decline for somebody to remain hospice eligible, right? When I first started at a hospice, they just had to meet the requirement to have a terminal diagnosis to remain in hospice care. So we had an Alzheimer's patient for 5+ years in hospice because she was one of those who was, she was about 30% for 5 years or more and didn't change very much. Some of the interventions might be storytelling, and whether it is reminding, telling stories about their own lives that families can do, family members can do, or just introducing something new. I just ran across something that was new to me. It's called, let's see if I get it right, timeslips.org. there's a website that, has anybody heard or been facilitated in that training? Timeslips.org. Well, I read an article by a chaplain, and in the article, the chaplain mentioned that he was a trainer, that he had training in timeslips.org. So I looked it up, and it looks really interesting. What it is, but it looks like something that you might be able to do without being having the official training, where the facilitator sits down with a picture with somebody who has dementia or memory loss and a family member, preferably. And they facilitate the interaction between the patient and the family member around the story. So they come up with a story. It's just imaginative. So the video that I saw on the website, Times Lips, had a video, and they had a picture of a man and a woman sword fighting. And so the facilitator was asking the patient the patient and his wife, asked them, okay, so what are their names? What do you think is happening? Why are they fighting? Where are they? What is going, where do they go from here? Who's watching this go on? And so they started telling this story, and they were interacting in this new way, which was really kind of fun for them, I think, and to be able to come up with a story together that doesn't require for somebody to remember necessarily. But I just thought there might be other ways you can integrate that storytelling. Music, I know you all probably have experience where you have talked with somebody who perhaps has dementia and they're not able to talk a lot, or they don't respond appropriately to questions, but you start singing their favorite hymn or song, and they sing every word or scripture too. And how powerful music is, and how people are sometimes who are not even verbal are able to sing when you start singing their favorite song. We already talked about scripture, sacred texts. And again, I have the early advanced care planning, and that's mostly for family because it is so difficult to prepare for death, and also because you have to reassess those goals, ongoing reassessment, which I think I have right there, of the goals of care. Because, after another trip to the hospital or after they've now stopped eating, then what? Might have to do an ongoing conversation about advanced care planning. Anything else before we move on with oh my gosh, it's 10:47, so we have like 3 minutes. Which that's okay, because I only had like one slide. Yeah, do you like that? And so I'll just say a couple of words, and then Bill, you might have something to say about this, or it will be interesting to get your perspective, because talking about chaplains as a strategic partner, partnering, good Lord, can't even talk now that I'm running out of time, with physicians especially about how to provide spiritual care. One thing, it's not a fully developed thought for me, but it's been on my mind in the last year or so, which is, I don't know if anybody's familiar with Eugene Peterson, who wrote The Message and Contemplative Pastor and other books. He, in his Contemplative Pastor book, he talks about the subversive role of the pastor. And this is Christian language, but he talks about how the parables of Jesus were subversive because they start talking about ordinary things and people's defenses are lowered, and then it explodes like a time bomb and it catches them, and then they understand that it was really about God and how it's life changing. But a lot of times how the pastor at the end of the service, people will come up and pat the pastor on the back and feel like, oh, that was nice, but now we're going back to the real world, and not really understand the impact of the message or the gospel, if you talk about it from a Christian perspective. And so I've been wondering about that in the chaplaincy context, because it is a lot of times in the healthcare context, it feels to me like a lot of times we're viewed as the fluff of medicine, nice, but not essential, not necessary, just like a little nice pat on the back and a prayer that's how people might perceive us, and not fully understanding the significance of spirituality to coping with illness, to health, to everything else. So I feel like sometimes we may be subversive by nature because people don't quite get yet the connection between what's going on spiritually and physically. But also it is effective because it is subversive. Maybe because people see the chaplain and most of the time their defenses are lowered, perhaps. I don't know. Sometimes, you know, people have been really angry when I show up. The chap, you call the chap. I'm not dying. But usually, you know, because people's defenses are lowered and they may not. All right, so quickly, before we end, one way is acting as an interpreter for the healthcare team, because a lot of times people are not as versed in healthcare as we might be, and so for them to understand the language that's been thrown at them, especially if they are used to framing things in spiritual terms, we can be really helpful in providing interpretation for our nurses and doctors and social workers. Clinical documentation, I have found it to be helpful when I have been able to document where doctors can see it and to not be so vague, but to be able to, I have found that some actually read my notes, and that has been helpful. Committee service has been really helpful, especially ethics, because it's so closely related to what we do. But I remember a former supervisor of mine said, encouraged me to be part of committees because that's how doctors and other people will interact with you and see you in a different way and get to know your expertise through committee service together. So if you're not part of a committee, that might be something you might want to look into. Educating team members in spiritual care. One thing that I put up as part of your PDF download is the Meyer Spiritual Suffering Risk Scale. And this was something Bonnie Meyer came up with, and it's a numeric scale that rates spiritual distress. And what's nice about that is that doctors and nurses, they're used to numeric scales, and social workers. And so this may be a good way to talk with them about spiritual distress, because it's something that's more easy for them to understand in team developments and initiatives. And I am so sorry we are out of time, but if there's any last comment, it's 10:52. Nope. Well, thank you all very much for taking the time to be here this morning. I hope you have a great trip home.